as it says, this is a brainstorming session. The idea is really to have a very open discussion, people being able to share ideas, experiences, suggestions for possible solutions that this group might be looking at. Just to place this in context, this is not a policy development process yet. The council is expected to vote on this issue coming Wednesday. I think the expectation is that it will be adopted. There hasn't been much discussion or objection to these issues as they have come from a review, I think, that started in 2005. So the idea is to record all the points made here and pass them on to the working group once they get started and make sure that finds its way in the report. And of course, I hope that all of you here are willing as well to participate and sign up for the working group. You can tell me or Glenn after the meeting if you're not on the mailing list yet to be added. So my idea would be, unless there are any objections, just to run through the issues report and its main findings. And I basically stop at each. There are five issues that are covered in this Part B. And basically then stop on each of these issues and get people's input. I mean, one issue is related to a report that the ASAC wrote, so I'm very grateful to see that Dave is here and Jeremy, so hopefully they can give some input here. There were some comments in the issues report that were made, for example, by GoDaddy, so I'm hoping as well that Japes can share some light on that. And I think it will be very helpful as well to see, as some of these issues, you know, were reported in 2005, to see whether they're actually still relevant or whether there are any changes or whether any elements this group will need to take into account when they start looking at these issues. Oh, you can just go back up.
Hey, Marika, would you do the favor of just kind of running through what the five issues are real quick at the outset?
Yeah, we're coming up on that. And I don't know, maybe we should do a quick tour the tablet so everyone at least knows who's in the room. So, well, Mike, maybe you can start on that side and just...
Sure. I'm Mike Rodenbaugh, GNSO Council from the business constituency.
William McKelligott, ICANN Contractual Compliance.
Olaf Nordling, ICANN Staff. And excuse, sorry for that.
Mike Zepke, ICANN Staff.
Margie Milam, ICANN Staff.
Glenn de Saint-Gerie, ICANN Staff.
Mm-hmm. Rudolf Garrow from Nauru. I'm with the Centpac Net. We're looking after .nr. Is that enough information?
Okay. Hi, I'm Mohammed from Somalia. I'm just gathering information about this whole event. Thanks.
James Bladel from GoDaddy.
Jeremy Hitchcock from Dynamic Network Services.
Dave Piscatello, ICANN Staff.
Feel free to come and sit here at the table because there's plenty of space. And then you have a microphone as well to contribute. So just for those...
I'm sorry, Marika. Is there anyone on the phone, or is there remote access to...
There is remote access, but I haven't heard. Is there anyone on the phone?
No
one yet.
Sorry, go ask them again. I may
have...
Hey, Barbara.
I'm sorry.
Can you hear as well?
It's a little bit soft, but not listening closely yet.
Okay. The presentation is up as well in the Adobe Connect room that Glenn sent around yesterday, the council room. So if you want to log in, you can see the presentation there as well.
Marika, this is Mike O'Connor. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hey, Mikey.
The Adobe Connect room
You have to go to the one that Glenn sent yesterday. We initially sent out another address, but it's the one that Glenn sent out yesterday to the IRTP mailing list. It's, I think, GNSO Council.
Barbara, can you see it?
You know what? I don't see it, but I'm going to see if I can find some other recent email.
Yeah, I'm looking at our most recent one. It's not a big deal, Mike. I wouldn't worry about
it. It was sent yesterday, Mike.
Carry on. Just wanted to let you know it's not going
to... Okay. Well, I'll have it open, so I'll see you appearing. So, So just for those of you that are new to this issue, the inter-registrar transfer policy was adopted in 2004 and is a consensus policy that basically sets out how domain name holders can transfer domain names between registrars. When this policy was adopted, the group immediately decided as well that it would be a good idea to carry out a review to determine whether the policy was working as it was supposed to be, whether there were any elements that were missing, or whether there were any areas that were unclear or not used as they were supposed to or were intended to. So an overall review was carried out, and a working group identified a whole list of issues that they deemed were suitable for improvement or clarification. And those were divided into one PDP on denial, the reasons for denials of a transfer that has already been wrapped up. And then there were five other IRTP PDPs identified, of which one has already been has already been wrapped up as well on IRTP Part A, which was looking at some new issues related to IRTP. On this last one, the Part B, the Council decided that trying to move up the speed a bit and take advantage of putting some similar issues together, they put three issues from the set A or set B that was identified by this transfer working group, and some identified in the set C together into one IRTP Part B. And the issues in this one are mainly looking at undoing transfers and issues related to a registrar lock status. So the issues report on this was submitted to the GENOSO Council on the 15th of May, and they had some initial discussions on that in their previous meeting. And as I said before, they're expected to vote on whether to initiate a PDP at the public meeting on Wednesday. So this is just very briefly just the overview of all the issues that are covered in this PDP. We'll now go into each of these in more detail, but you know, you can have a quick read so you get a feel for the issues that are covered here. So if we then move into the first one, which is on the urgent return resolution of a domain name. Basically, the question here is, should there be an expedited handling process for fraud situations be developed? A staff report that was published in 2005 that basically looked at all the comments received and input received from the community provided some suggestions that there might be a need to develop an expedited handling process, or looking at automatically returning names that are subject to a dispute, return them to the original registrar until the dispute actually had been resolved, or automatically rolling back the name service to what they originally were. Then it was also discussed in the ASIC hijacking report. I think maybe it's better to turn over to Dave to give a little bit of feedback what that report recommended, and maybe start a discussion from there. I've listed here as well, because in the report we did cover some issues are obvious that will need to be taken into account if indeed the group would agree that this is an area where an expedited process would need to be developed, taking into account that there is a transfer resolution, dispute resolution process in place, but I think by many deemed that that takes too long, and in those cases, in hijacking cases, the damage might be too great that there is a need for urgent return. There are some questions that will need to be considered, like what is the actual extent of the problem? Does that warrant a new policy or a new dispute resolution process? How do you ensure a fair process? Who would be the decision maker? Who determines whether it's a fraudulent transfer or not? Or are there any market solutions or best practices that actually already deal with this issue? So that's something that needs to be taken into account. So maybe, Dave, if you can tell us a little bit more about the ASIC report on this issue. To put on the microphone.
The ESSAC report is actually from 2005, and I think the terrain has certainly changed quite a bit in 4 years. The primary purpose of the report was to respond to domain name hijackings that had become fairly noteworthy and fairly frequent in situations where a registrar was Registrar account was used and compromised by an attacker, and the attacker sought to transfer a domain, as opposed to the kind of attacks that are going on today, where the attacker actually wants to make use of the domain in more of a stealthy manner or more of a malicious manner. So what we tried to do in that report, and what we're continuing to do with the report that we distributed to the registrar constituency earlier this week, I guess late last week, is identify measures that registrars can take to improve authentication methods, improve ways to verify that a transaction is actually authorized by the appropriate legitimate registrant of a domain. And in the hijacking report, we have, we broke up a number of recommendations that we identified to registrants who could take measures on their own to try to protect themselves from, from the unauthorized transfer of a domain. And then we also mentioned a number of recommendations that we had made to registrars. Now, sort of anecdotal evidence suggests that a fair number of registrars have actually implemented some of these. But I don't think it's accurate to say that all the registrars have implemented all of them. I don't know how deeply you want me to go into this, but that really is the summary of what we did.
Well, I would be especially interested as well to hear a bit more about, because in the report you talk about having a emergency procedure, and you discuss some elements that this procedure could, should, might have, such, I listed them here, like an emergency action channel, I think it's more the 24/7 phone number you can call, the policy that would need to go with that, and the public awareness campaign. So,
these are fairly common kinds of points of contact that are needed for a number of purposes, not just in a registrar transfer. And I think the goal here is that there is some way for a registrant to contact his registrar in a very clear and unambiguous manner. There's some way for him to notify of an abuse, in this case an unauthorized transfer. And upon having that notice placed with the registrar would start some kind of auditing capability where the complainant could have some kind of tracking number or some kind of authorization that indicates that he's in a queue, he's going to be taken care of, that there's a record that starts of the investigation that the registrar would actually perform or conduct to determine whether or not the claim is legitimate. And if the claim is legitimate, then the question is how rapidly can the registrar rectify or remedy the unauthorized transfer. One of the important aspects of that is that if the community identifies a very clear set of criteria to a registrant, the kind of documentation that he must present to make a credible claim, like any other claim, like an insurance claim in a car accident, he's more likely to have better response if he provides as much exact detail as possible. So, accurate WHOIS information, an indication of when the party actually registered the domain, proof of purchase or the proof of completion of the transaction are all components of that. And once the registrar has that information, he can look at it and make a determine whether or not this is a credible case. It looks like the guy paid for it, looks like the guy actually registered it on this date. It doesn't look like any party that he authorized attempted the transfer, and I'm going to start an investigation. At that point, the registrars should act appropriately to say, this is probably an asset to that organization or individual. The purpose here is to try to accelerate the process of restoring the name to the to the complainant.
So a question that would come to my mind is then, who's in the end, or who should be the decision maker on whether a transfer is deemed fraudulent?
I think that's a very hard question, because there are different circumstances that probably beg different answers. If it's a situation where the information is not sufficiently clear, or there is some sort of intellectual property dispute, or their, you know, the paper trail, so to speak, is not particularly clear. I mean, I could imagine a situation where a registrar might want to reach out to someone else and say, I don't know how to make this decision. But, you know, I'm not a registrar. I mean, there are some clear-cut cases, I'm sure, and that's the easy, you know, the easy path. The harder cases are where there's a legitimate dispute as to whether or not the transaction was approved or not. The other cases that I can think that come to mind that are hard are situations where an organization believes that it registered a domain, but in fact someone in IT who no longer is a party to that organization registered in his own name, and before he left altered the contact information so that it was his personal address, personal residence, personal phone. You know, those are much more challenging disputes, and I can understand that a registrar would find a certain amount of difficulty in pulling the trigger and saying, this was DuPont.com or this was ATT.com, and you really aren't, an officer of the company. And, I question whether it belongs to you. But then maybe there are other cases that are not so clear where it's Joe's bargainbasement.org. And the guy's name is Joe, and the name in the company was Joe's Bargain Basement. So it's not very clear.
Yeah, the question, and it's maybe a question I'd like to ask to James, then, would it make sense to have a policy? Or, if as the cases are so diverse, would it be easier or more effective to indeed look at registers, how they deal with it, and give them, the leeway of saying, well, look at the case by case, and you still have, of course, the dispute resolution procedure that people can enter to, but if there's really a need for a quick resolution and then for the real obvious cases, isn't that already being done in a, registrar between registrar manner? Or
yeah, and I just want to say Dave's absolutely correct that there's a very high volume of transfer disputes like this, and you can take maybe 75, maybe 80%, I don't know what the exact figures are, and say these are very clear cut, and there's a it's very intuitive what we need to do here. The remainder, though, I think is requires a more in-depth investigation, understanding the different parties involved, the sequence of the events, and sometimes even looking into outside factors, if there was a split between two principals in a small business or something like that. And I think, as a whole, we should be very cautious when we wade into here with policy, because what we're going to do is we may bring some consistency to this area, but we also take away a lot of discretion and latitude. And I believe, that most of the very, major registrars are acting in good faith and trying to sort this whole thing out and trying to make sure that the rightful individuals have their registrations returned to them. I did want to point out, though, that we possibly could look at existing policy, particularly with the TDRP, and how that's working, how effective that might be, whether or not any improvements or enhancements or clarifications or consistencies could be implemented in an existing policy like the TDRP, because I think that tool perhaps is maybe underutilized, maybe it's not trusted, maybe it's applied inconsistently. So rather than, trying to impose different standards all over the place, I think we should take the standards we have and put them under a microscope and see if we're getting the outputs from them that we're expecting.
Dave, Mike? If just to remind, if you can just say your name, just for the record, for the people who are listening to the recording afterwards.
This is Dave Piscatello again. You asked a question that is actually not one of those three, and one of the things that I think could be useful for for a working group, a pre-PDB working group or whatever, to do is develop a matrix of the scenarios, and as you say, there probably are 80% that are fairly clear cut where you have agreement between the originating registrar and the receiving registrar, where you have sufficient documentation, where you have a clear clear paper trail, and those are easy. Then if you go through and you look at the possible scenarios, there might be a scenario where the two registrars disagree as to the quality of the data. the parties disagree as to the quality of data. And if you tease out those, it might be useful to then follow what you were saying, James, and look and see whether the existing TDRP accommodates each of those cells in the matrix. So that would require a little bit of rigor, but it might be useful to execute. Even if you do look at the TDRP and it looks like it's satisfying almost all the cases, I still think that having an emergency action channel is probably valuable, and it's probably something that would merit consideration in policy. And I do think that public awareness is probably valuable, because we have so many more domain registrants now, and people do are continuing to increase their appreciation of the asset value to their organization or to themselves, of the domains they register. So I think that would be useful, because you'd give people an awareness of what they can do, and it's also useful because it creates the appearance for the registrar community that they are interested in customer care, and they are reaching out and trying to be proactive in helping people in situations where there might be a problem.
That's Mike Rodenbaugh. So I agree with James on this one. This seems to me to be an area we really do need to be cautious with, because you could really open up a huge can of worms for where almost every domain transfer could be questioned just by a simple allegation of fraud. And I'm also not really aware of a large problem here personally. So I'd love to get some statistics and understand. I mean, is this something that people complain to ICANN about a lot anymore, or to registrars? Because personally, I don't hear it. I do hear plenty of cases of where the IT guy or the web host or the web designer got the domain in the first instance. But you're not talking about fraudulent transfer there. You're talking about a legitimate transfer at the outset, and then later the company realizes, oops, we should have registered that in our name, not in that guy's name. But that's not a fraudulent transfer, so not something we're really talking about here. So I don't know. Do we have any data now, or maybe that should really be the first step on this one?
Well, maybe a question to ask to William and Mike, and well, maybe James as well. How often do you come across these kind of cases? Does ICANN get a lot of complaints? Does the compliance team get many complaints that specifically relate to this, or is this an area where you would need to investigate a little bit more? You might be able to come back to the group on that.
Yes. So the contractual compliance.
Sorry, say your name, William.
Yes, William McKelligott. So the contractual compliance team regularly receives complaints from the community about transfer disputes. I could probably find statistics for the for this group. The ones that I have dealt with have been primarily related to transfers involving resellers. So kind of a variation here. I don't know if Mike has anything to add.
Yeah. So this is Mike Zupke. So I don't look at the complaints as closely as I used to. That's kind of been shifted in the compliance area. But I think that the genuine hijacking complaints have probably reduced since the implementation of auth codes across all GTLDs. That doesn't diminish the fact that when it does happen to somebody, it's really significant to them. And there, I think, are often cases where a registrar says, there's not enough evidence for us to try and undo the claimed damage that was done. So I think that. The thing that we hear from people who do have this problem is often that they feel there should be a process that they could invoke rather than relying on their registrar to invoke a process to dispute a transfer.
Addressing your question, Mike, I don't know if we have statistics on each of the types of categories of or the buckets that these might fall into, but I know that it's probably in the order of hundreds or possibly even thousands a month. Incidents where we're trying to kick off an investigation to figure out what happened during a transfer. And regardless of the actual number, there's a couple of high-profile cases, some involving ICANN contracted parties and some involving ICANN themselves, losing control through an unauthorized transfer, losing control of their DNS. So I think it is still an issue. I mean, not being around for the original 2005 report, I don't know if it was if it's improved, but certainly, it seems to be an ongoing challenge.
Thank you. I'm Mohammed Ibrahim. I just want to add couple of comments on this. I'm not really sure about how these stats are collected or who's collecting them, but I just want to give you a different perspective about from the community. For example, from North Africa, Middle East, and parts of Africa, the major issue is when the name or the domain name expires, straight away the next day it's gone. And there is a lag. Sometimes people forget to renew their domain names, and it causes a lot of problems for a lot of businesses, and it puts off a lot of people also using the internet. They will say, look, I really can't register my company's name because after I start everything, and the next day it might go somewhere to Hong Kong or somewhere else, and I can never get it again. So I'm not really sure whether that will add anything to the discussion. But a lot of people don't even know the process. Then what to do? Who do you talk to? And when you go to ICANN.com, it's huge. It's like the UN. It's very difficult to find information and to actually know who do you talk to and so on. So, for example, GoDaddy, to their credit, sometimes they allow, they add value by saying we can cover you for another week or month or something, but you have to buy insurance policy or something. And that works because sometimes people forget the exact date, and then at least they have some time to catch up and to renew the domain name. So that's really, we did a quick research some time ago, 6 months ago, in the UAE and a few other countries. Huge problem, because not only people lose their domain name, but sometimes other people register their company's name in advance. So if you're XYZ and you want to register, all of a sudden XYZ is gone and there's nothing you can do. And then people just say, well, forget it. I'll call myself XYZ123 or something. Or even forget about the whole idea and say, look, it's not worth it. This is chaos. So this sort of might tell you that.
On the issue of expiration, I can maybe invite you to come to a workshop that we're organizing on Wednesday that's going to specifically look at the expiration of domain names and what happens during that process or that part of the domain name life cycle, because there are indeed some issues, as you mentioned, where there have been complaints or questions raised. So that's a separate process that will has started as well. So please come to that meeting, and hopefully we'll hear more on that. Coming back to one point that Mike made, because I'm not sure whether I think it's an issue that comes up as well in one of the later PDPs on related to the TDRP, because as I understand, for the moment, it's only registrars that can actually launch a procedure. And one of the questions I think that's being raised in one of the other issues, but that might be relevant here, is, as some of you mentioned, that might be an area that this group might look at, is whether it should be possible for registrants to launch a complaint. Just an idea that might be considered. I mean, I don't very little of the TDRP, but from some of the materials I read, I've understood that it's actually very little used. I don't know if anyone has any information on that or experience. I mean, sorry, James or Tim.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a valid question. The issue is trying to kind of balance that with the way that registrars try to work with each other. So I think one of the reasons that there aren't a lot of disputes actually filed is because I know at GoDaddy, for example, we try to have relationships with all the other registrars, as many as we can. And so when we have a problem, the first thing we'll do is contact another registrar and we try to work things out. And probably, you know, 90%+ of the time we're able to do that, just to work it out between ourselves. And so the dispute mechanism isn't needed. So while I think that's a valid question, you know, should registrants be able to initiate that, I'd still, you know, we want to consider that. We don't want to create, you know, a huge onslaught of disputes because the process that registrars have kind of worked out among themselves gets circumvented because it goes straight to a dispute, when in that reality it might be able to get handled quicker and with less mess, you know, between the registrars. So I think that's a good question, because I think we've seen that where there are some registrars who don't make that very easy, you know, for registrants to know that there is a dispute resolution system, and if you can't get things resolved, that there's another avenue. So there might be something there we could do, but I wouldn't want to just, you know, circumvent the registrars altogether.
Margie?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on something Tim said, and Mike can probably comment on this, but the registrars have, through ICANN, put in contacts for transfer disputes, right? in the radar system where you actually identify an internal contact purely for transfer disputes. So a lot of this stuff gets, just like Tim says, gets resolved behind the scenes, quickly through those contacts. I just don't know how if that's changed the experience on, some of these hijackings recently or if it's affected it. But I know that is a system that seems to work informally.
Yeah, so this is Mike. Kind of as a little bit of background on how that works. ICANN has always maintained a list of transfer contacts at all registrars, and they're allowed to voluntarily provide that information to us. We treat that as confidential information that's shared only with registrars and registries. It's supposed to be a sort of an express channel for registrars to use, and so what Margie's referring to now is that we've sort of automated that process of collecting the data and making it available through the web interface that registrars have, which I don't know if that's made it more usable for registrars or not, but that's kind of the system that she's talking about.
So maybe last comment before we move on to the next issue, because we still have four other issues to cover as well. So.
Add to that as well by saying that the TDRP is a time-consuming process, or can be, compared to something that's a little more expedited. I think when you're dealing with a claim of hijacking, you're looking at hours of reaction time, and just getting that process started could be longer than that. So it really cuts down on that window.
Any final comments on this issue?
Actually, I just have a question, and does an incorrect suspension of a domain fall into the category of of something that would be urgently returned? So if somebody has a false positive in identifying a domain as a phish domain or as a spam domain or a fast flux domain, and it's suspended, is there a separate process that falls outside this process at most registrars? This is perhaps an aside, but I was just curious.
I think people might have to come back to you on that one.
Yeah, can we?
Yeah, well, let's just do that side. That's fine. I'm curious.
Okay, maybe we can then continue to the next issue, which raises the question on whether there should be additional provisions for undoing inappropriate transfers. So the IRTP is clear that the registrant can overrule the admin contact, but how this is implemented is currently at the discretion of the registrar. Some of the comments received during the different public comments periods indicated that the return of inappropriate transfers is considered to be difficult. The process seems unclear, as it's left to the registrar to define how this is done. I guess are different practices used. This is an issue that also came up in the IRTP Part A working group, who also recommended that the appropriateness of a policy change that would prevent a registrant from reversing a transfer after it has been completed and authorized by the admin contact should be considered. So I copied here a comment that was actually put in by GoDaddy on this issue, and you can read online, and I'm hoping that Tim and Tim Honor James would share a little bit more information on this. So basically saying as well that, there's a lot of unclarity in this area, and they've raised the question as well, is this the intent of the policy, or is this indeed an area that needs further work? So who would like to comment?
Mike? First of all, I'm not really grasping why this is all that much different from a previous issue, and why they wouldn't be dealt with in much the same way if we're assuming we're going to deal with it.
As I understand, part of this issue that you have that the registrant can overrule the admin contact. So in certain cases, understand that once the admin contact has approved and has all gone through the whole process, it has been transferred, and then the registrant suddenly stands up and, I didn't authorize it, please roll it back. And I understand that causes a lot of problems and a lot of delays.
Sure, but basically they're just saying it was a fraudulent transfer from the admin contact. Right.
Yeah. Tim.
Yeah, I mean that's basically true. But the difference is that the registrar that took the gaining registrar will say, well, you know, we follow the process, you know, according to the policy, you know, the admin contact can approve, the admin contact did approve it. And so they want to, they do want to correct it, but then we run into that issue usually where, you know, the registrar wants to be indemnified. And I know GoDaddy's been, you know, we take that position as well. So if we're going to reverse what we saw as a good transfer because the registrant overrides it, you know, then we just want to be indemnified from any possible action, you know, that might take place after that as a result. In other words, we don't want to admit, yeah, this was a fraudulent transfer and we were a party to it. It's a different situation. And so that raises some issues because some registrars are okay, you know, with indemnifying under that circumstances. Some aren't. You know, it just depends on the registrar. So it does raise a little bit different issue because it was actually technically a good transfer, you know, at the outset.
So here, yeah, what you're basically you're asking is for the registrant to indemnify you in the event the admin contact comes back and says it was legit, whereas in the first case, you would really want the gaining registrar to, the losing registrar would want indemnification, right? But I mean, indemnity is a whole other issue. I don't know that we were really developed policy around that, around registrars indemnifying one another, right? Never done that before, right. Anyway.
Yeah, this is Tim again. Yeah, true, and I'm not. I don't think that's necessarily what we're suggesting, but is there some policy change that's needed or clarification that will allow registrars to take care of that situation without expecting that kind of thing? You know, do we need to look at whether or not, you know, the registrant is the only one that can actually approve a transfer? Or, you know, if they're going to appoint an administrative contact as a transfer authority, then that's not revocable. I think that's the kind of question that we're actually raising.
If I recall well, I think something that was discussed in the IRTP Part A working group was as well saying, well, we don't want to take away the right for the registrant to object in a certain window of time, but once the transfer has been completed and fully authorized, maybe then it needs to be looked at that it cannot be rolled back if indeed it has been properly approved by the admin contact. I think that was one of the errors that was discussed.
This is Barbara. This is actually one of the more common issues that we see in the registry that come to us. And I will say that the
any other comments or questions, James?
And just to add to this, going back to the IRTPA PDP, is that the registrant contact information, especially unless we're talking about a thick registry, is an invisible entity to the gaining registrar until that time. So not only is it this person that can, or this contact that can override the administrative contact, but it can also, doesn't really leave them any recourse to contact that person.
This is Jeremy Hitchcock. Just another concept on the whole administrative contact is that registrars are always validating who the actual entity that owns the domain name through proxy, through some sort of web interface, through some sort of email password combination, and it's that itself has some issues for verifying that an actual contact is the person who is in the whois information. The person that actually registered the domain name. And so there's always this, not a mismatch all the time, but certainly whoever's in whois as the admin contact as the owner of the domain name is sometimes different and authenticated by the registrar through a different means or through some sort of secondary token.
Any other comments, questions? No? And I propose we move on to... Oh.
I'd just say the same thing again, though. It'd be really helpful before we start digging into possible alternatives to understand the scope of the problem. Getting stats around this again would be really useful to see if this is still a problem, you know, 4 years after these comments were taken.
Barbara, would you be in a position to share some data on how frequent this occurs?
I don't have my records right now, but I'm happy to
Okay, that would be great, and I think we'll look as well from the compliance department and the services department at ICANN to see if we can pull up some data there as well, because I think it would be helpful.
I would say the overall number of transfers that we received has gone down significantly. We're at more quarterly transfers than we have in the past.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So moving on to the next issue, which raises the question or whether there should be special provisions for a change of registrant near the change of a registrar. So the IRTP does not currently deal with changes of registrants, which often figures in hijacking cases. Some of the comments received indicated, you know, the liability for fraudulent transfers currently lies with the losing registrar, and some registrars therefore have taken preventive measures, such as optional transfer prohibition periods following a change of registrant. Some time ago, ICANN did clarify that a registrant change to WHOIS information is not a valid basis for denying a transfer request, as some complaints had been received in relation to that. Some registrants consider such measures unnecessarily restrictive, so the fact that if they change WHOIS data, they cannot transfer the name out for a certain amount of time. I think this is one of the areas where, you know, the question should be asked, how much of a issue this still is, because I think the clarification that was provided by ICANN has, I think, at least taken away this the mandatory nature of by which some registrars applied this procedure, and as I understand, this has now changed into an option where the registrant, when they change the WHOIS information details, they can actually opt in to a 2 months or 3 months, I don't know what the standard is, prohibition period for a transfer. So the question there as well are, you know, is this still an area? Are there still complaints received? Do registrants still feel that they should be able to change that even if they've opted in at that stage? So I would like to open the floor for comments, questions. I don't know, again, looking to to Tim and James, maybe some, you know, what is the practice at GoDaddy? How do you deal with that? Do you feel this is an area that would require special provisions?
Let me just clarify something for you. I think, at least with GoDaddy, and I think most registrars that I'm aware of, it's not optional. It's mandatory, where if you change your WHOIS information, you cannot transfer for 60 days. You don't get the option to opt in or out of that. It's absolutely mandatory. And I think there's an issue there with some registrars about disclosing that fact, that it's not disclosed prominently, and some registrants don't realize that that's happening. And then they're stuck with their registrar for another 2 months when, in fact, they want to move it to their own registrar after a transfer.
That's it.
So we've refined our process over the years as you know, issues have arisen, complaints, concerns with ICANN and others. But the way we deal with it right now is that we look at it as, you know, if a domain name is changing hands from one registrant to another, you know, it's a different situation. It's not really something that we're required to support, you know, in our RAA. You know, updates to the WHOIS is one thing. A completely new registrant is a whole different thing. And so one thing is we want to make sure that we have a registration agreement in place with the new registrant. So we have a process that you go through if you're going to do that, that both the losing registrant and the gaining registrant is made aware of the fact that, you know, this is a service that we're going to provide to you. We provide it free under the condition that once completed, you know, the domain name, you agree that you won't transfer the domain name for 60 days. And then we explain if that's not going to work for you, you know, the option is transfer the domain name first and then complete the change of ownership at the new registrar. And so if they complete the process, they've been fully informed, and then the domain name is held locked for 60 days. We make exceptions to that. I mean, if that happens and someone calls and it's an issue, you know, we do some due diligence, make sure things are cool, and then we'll quite often you know, lift that restriction and let them transfer the domain name. So that's kind of the way we handle it. I know it's probably handled differently by other registrars. But that is key to us because that's been, we've seen in the past that it's like it's probably the first thing that happens before a hijacking attempt, is that that who is information is changed. In fact, the way we do it now, it's you know, there has to be an actual change of registrant. I mean, at one time we were preventing it even if anything with the transfer authority changed, any of the contacts. So if the email address of the admin contact changed, or if the email address that we keep on file that isn't public of the registrant changed, we would do it then as well. We've stopped doing that. We think that's opened up a window of opportunity for hijacking, unfortunately. But I think it's something that needs to be looked at because it is, it precedes attempts to hijack very, very often. And I think even the current report from the ESSAC has kind of recognized that fact as well.
Any other, Mike?
No, I do think that's really the problem is, you know, GoDaddy does prominently notify people of this, but like Tim said, all the registrars are kind of different, and this maybe is one area where there ought to be consistent standards and firm rules.
So, Mike, William, is this an area where I can get a lot of complaints? Are you aware, or can you look into that and maybe share that with the group at a later stage if you don't have that offhand?
Yeah, so I can say, this is Mike, we get considerably fewer complaints than we did, since the advisory was posted. I think that a lot of registrars have, been able to look at that and try to conform their procedures accordingly. I understand from what Tim is saying that, they got certain procedures in place. They want to create an electronic paper trail of changes of registrants. That's generally, in the interest of protecting their customers. So I think, though, if there's a sense that that's not a desirable thing, then the advisory doesn't solve that problem. I think that should be clear. And I'm not saying that what they're doing is a problem, but if that's the sense that what they're doing is still not acceptable, then something besides the advisory would be necessary. But also, I think it's worth looking at the thing that Tim mentioned, whether it changes to, for example, the administrative contact email address should perhaps trigger some sort of a delay in transferability. And I'm not saying that's necessarily right, but I think it's something that, should be looked at by the community.
Dave?
Yeah, this is Dave again. The wording of the third bullet where it says the information is not a valid basis for denying a transfer request sort of tickled something in the intrusion detection corner of my brain, which is that it's always dangerous to use one marker to declare something as being a positive case because you're only relying on that to as the distinguishing factor for a true positive versus a false positive. One of the situations that I know has happened to me on several occasions with transferring registrations is that the transfers occur close to the time when somebody is about to renew and the cost is something that they want to just actually avoid. For example, if you are supporting a not-for-profit website and you are that not-for-profit wants to actually move the site and this has happened to me on a couple of occasions. What we've done is we've essentially gone through the process of I registered the domain and got people set up on a web server and then their web service got a little bit more than I wanted to handle as a volunteer, and they decided to upload it to GoDaddy, as an example. My goal was to simply get the name, domain name, into the new contact and new registrant's identity. One of the things you might consider is that you could think of additional parameters that you might use and. If the contact information is being changed within a certain number of days of a renewal event, maybe that's not quite as clear-cut a case as a transfer that occurs any other time of the year when information's information is modified. These are just off the top of my head notions, but one of the things that I'm suggesting is that maybe you don't want to only rely on one factor to prohibit it, but think of other factors that would also help you distinguish between a hijacking case and just a fortunate or unfortunate sequence of events. Yeah.
Marjorie?
I just wanted to follow up on what Dave was saying, because there are a lot of legitimate reasons for a registrant change before a transfer, like a purchase, if a secondary sale of a domain name. What would typically happen is you'd have a buyer who purchases the name, then they want to move it to their registrar. So there's a lot of legitimate reasons for why that might happen, and you want to make sure that you're not somehow preventing those legitimate situations.
James?
Agreed, Marchie. Going back to what Tim was saying, there really isn't a mechanism for that sale I think, an obligation for registrars to police that commercial market, whereas there is, with IRTP, this is just specifically on the transfers. So exchanging, if you and I, for example, were going to buy and sell domain names and we both had accounts at GoDaddy, then this would not ever come up as an issue. Okay, it's the fact that those things are trying to occur simultaneously and that we're trying to attach something to an existing policy that is causing some of the confusion. I also wanted to touch on something Dave said earlier relative to the ESSAC report that's not out yet. Is that correct? I've been chatting with Jeremy.
So,
ESSAC 40?
Could
you turn off your microphone?
This is Dave again. I think it's fine for you to talk about the report. I mean, it's not published primarily because we wanted to share it with the registrars and give you an opportunity to have this kind of discussion. So, yes, so by all means, if there's something that you want to talk about, let's do it.
Well, I don't want to steal too much of its thunder.
The goal is to not have thunder. It's to have agreement. Yeah,
but there's an excellent point in there about having multiple points of contact relative to a registration and not necessarily having all or nothing global transfer authority or who has changed authority or any other types of operations that you can perform on a registration, but having perhaps tiered or limited or restricted authority for some contacts and then having administrative authority for other contacts. And I think that when we're talking about a change of registrant prior to a transfer, what we're talking about from an intrusion detection is we're talking about a brand new account on a mainframe, let's say, that's seconds old, having root level authority.
Exactly.
You know, and I don't know that any IT or CISO would go for that in the world. So really, that's what we're talking about is something that's brand new. And one of the ideas I think that was even touched on in your report is the idea that think of that 60-day or 45-day or 10-day cooling off period as a way to age the account to get an idea of what purpose it was, maybe even allow for a authorization window by one of the existing accounts or contacts on that registration to say that it's legitimate or not. So I think that, using that example, if you had someone that came onto your network, created a brand new account, and as soon as they hit the submit button, they had root access to everything that you had, I think most people would have see the problems therein. So,
yeah, I think Dave will definitely have you back on the working group when that report is out to share a bit more on that, if you don't mind. So when that ESSAC report comes out, maybe you would like to join the working group again for a session to explain a bit how that might work. So, great. Any other comments or questions on this particular issue? So then, moving on to the next one, I think the next two are very closely related, so I'll quickly run through both of them, and I think then we can open the discussion. They're both related to the registrar lock status and question D is whether there should be standards or best practices be implemented regarding the use of register lock status, so when it may not be used, when it should or should not be applied. the different public comment periods indicated that there are many variations in which the use of lock status occurs. Registrars have different practices. This seems to have added a level of complexity. A lot of registrants do not understand or are confused about how they can actually unlock their domain names. So the consideration should be given whether there's a need for greater standardization of locking and unlocking functions, or whether there should be more precise definitions in the IRGP on the appropriate use of lock status. So closely related to that is the last issue on clarification of denial reason number 7, which basically says that a domain name was already in lock status provided that the registrar provides a readily accessible and reasonable means for the registered name holder to remove the lock status. So as said, the practices vary, so registrants often don't know how to do this. And again, should there be greater standardization to this mechanism, more precise definition? This issue was already discussed in a previous PDP on denials, but I think, and I'm going to turn to Olaf to share a little bit more on that, but I think it was deemed that it required more time and discussion to solve this issue, that it was decided to pass it on. And again, as it is closely linked to the previous question, I think the group might want to consider taking both of those together and addressing those. So Olaf, if you can maybe tell us a little bit more about what has already been discussed in relation to this issue and what the group found at that stage, that would be great. Thanks.
Absolutely. Olaf Nordlingen. Once upon a time, there was a PDP. On clarification of denial reasons, two of out of four we achieved clarifications of, and those have been changed. But two were leftovers, and this is one of them, where... Well, if you look at the denial reason, I mean, it in this drafting group which addressed it, looked very much at the part of it which says a readily accessible and reasonable means. And that was sort of the core provision. It's pretty rubbery. And the question was, could that be more specific or better defined? And it was discussed at some length, and the more we discussed it, the more we realized that the reasons and use of registrar lock varied between registrars, and actually to be more specific, and especially in that particular time frame, to come with some kind of clarification of it wasn't really doable and could have adverse effects, making it, well, in some cases, unnecessarily difficult, and in other cases, taking away the existing options that the registrars have, or for the registrants to opt in for particular security provisions. So, well, the advice, the recommendation was really to link this, to rather dodge it from the perspective of that particular drafting group, and recommend that it was addressed together with this wider issue of the use of register lock. So, well, Tim and others, maybe you could expand if needed on the work in the previous working group, which concluded its work right just around a year ago from now. But that's essentially it. The conclusion was, well, this is more than a clarification that's needed, and it better be addressed together with other discussions about register lock status as such. Thanks.
Tim, please go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. It's that original PDP group, or the original group that was, where this is discussed, was only asked to look at clarifications of some specific reasons for denial. And as Olaf said, we just felt that this required probably something more than just a clarification. For example, you know, a number of registrars will, you know, they apply a lock, sort of an internal lock, It's not something that shows up when you do a who is at a registry. So it might not even look like the name's locked at the registry potentially, yet the registrar has it sort of locked internally. So that's something registrants may or may not be aware of. And then some registrars do that as a default when the domain name's registered. Some offer services around that kind of a lock, where a registrant can opt in for additional security, additional measures need to be taken before any changes can be made to the domain name, that kind of thing. So there's just a wide range of issues surrounding why there's these various lock statuses, and that we felt it was more of a policy issue than it was just a clarification. So that's kind of why it was moved into here.
Maybe a follow-up question to you then. What would be a potential solution, or what do you think this group should be looking at? Is that a more, defining what lock status can be used for, or obliging registrars to use a different name for other locks they might use that are not the one defined in the IRTP? Or
just from my perspective, I think what the issue is the registrant being aware of what's happening, so that they're aware of the state of the domain name, they're aware of what they need to do when they want to transfer the domain name, and I don't think that's necessarily always the case. They may not really understand what the registrar himself has done to the domain name or what is affecting it, and it may not always be clear how to unlock. I mean, we're always, even at GoDaddy, we get questions about how to unlock the domain name. Yet, if you log into your account, there's just it's a simple link to unlock it. So we're always looking at, how can we better inform, registrants about that process. So I think that's to me is the key issue, is just make sure registrants are aware that they know what's necessary in order to make modifications to their name or to transfer it. I don't think that's necessarily always the case.
I don't know, Mike Williams, is this an area where we got a lot of complaints at ICANN? People being confused on how to do this?
So this is William McKelly. I would agree with you. I forget your name. I'm sorry.
Tim.
Primarily, the registrants are a bit unaware of why their domain name is in lock status, or what that implies, or how to get it unlocked. And but again, primarily the type of complaints that I have dealt with have involved resellers, which I think adds another wrinkle into this story, because many times these resellers become advocates for the registrants, and we're talking about several hundred or thousands of domains that they want to help transfer to another registrar. So it'd be kind of a variation of this, but I would agree that there is some type of lack of clarity what this implies, how it came to be, and how to actually move beyond being locked, having the domain name locked in lock status.
Olaf?
I would sort of, from a logical perspective, see this very much as the tail of the dog. The dog itself is more the use of register lock, and then we can sort of address this question, whether that could be clarified, that particular context. But so perhaps you could back one slide to D. I think that's a logical sequence to address them. D before E.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments, questions? Well, with that, I would like to thank you all very much for coming at this early hour and participating. And again, any of you that are interested in continuing discussions on these issues, please pass your details to me or Glenn when she comes back, so we can add you to the mailing list for this working group. As mentioned, we expect the council to discuss this issue in further detail on Wednesday, when they will take a decision on whether to initiate a PDP on this issue. Up here you'll find more information on where to find the background information and how you can participate. A wiki has been created, so even if you're not interested in getting on the mailing list, you can, you know, monitor discussions there. And as with any PDP, there will be opportunities to contribute during public comment periods and follow-up meetings we will be organizing. So, again, thank you very much, and have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara and Mikey.